All right. Good morning, everybody. It is Monday morning, September 20th, 11 a.m., 11:15, 11:18. And hey, we're into Alkynes this morning. We graduate from Alkenes into the Alkyne chapter is where we go next. So what I need to do, so I only have 32% recharge on my pen. I'll have to switch iPads midstream. Let's see what we can do here. Start a new screen share. Back into Notability, OCHEM, new lecture, and Alkynes. All right, this is exciting. The Alkyne chapter is very similar to the alkene chapter. There's a lot of reactions in common, but there are some unique differences. And so we need to be aware of some of the unique differences of these as we start to go through these reactions. So alkynes. First thing in looking at the alkynes, let's just do a comparison between alkynes and alkenes. When we look at an alkyne versus an alkene, the first thing to note is the difference in hybridization, right? And so we've got sp2 hybridized carbons, and they're trigonal planar. And here we've got the sp hybridized carbons. And so these guys are linear. Other differences include that when we are looking at sp2 hybridizations, that if we track sp3, sp2, and sp, and in terms of what that means for a for carbon in terms of its hybridization. What changes is the length of that hybrid orbital. Let's get this move a little bit. And so we're looking at really from the nucleus on out at length. And in terms of these hybridizations, sp3 is the longest, sp2 is medium, and SP is the shortest. But that has greater implications, huge implications, in terms of their electronegativities. That electronegativity is the ability of an atom to pull electrons. And if we look at this, this guy holds its electrons most tightly. And that means that this is most electronegative. And so electronegativity increases with hybridization. That's an important component. So when we look at a carbon acid versus a nitrogen acid versus an oxygen acid, and even HF, right, a halogen acid, that we can look at the pKa's of each one of these protons and talk about the acidity of the proton. And when we look at the proton, this has a pKa of 60, around 45, 16, and about 3. We know that that inherent electronegativity is what is giving rise to the greater acidity. That when I look at a C minus versus an N minus versus an O minus or an F minus, in losing these protons, that I'm going to a more electronegative element. And therefore, something that is inherently more stable with the negative charge. And that the more stable, oh, I just see we locked up. The more stable a conjugate base is, the stronger the acid is. Come on, lock in. What's going on? Something's wrong. Hang on. Checking to make sure I didn't jump back on that VPN for a minute. It doesn't want to click back in the way it's supposed to. Okay, I'm still on a trusted network, so it should click in. There we go. All right, so the more electronegative an element is, the more stable it is with the negative charge, and therefore the more the stronger the conjugate acid is. We can make a direct comparison between a carbon which has a proton on it and is sp3 versus a carbon that has a proton on it that is sp2. And a carbon that has a proton on it that is sp. And that the pKa of these guys tracks almost identically, pKa here, 20-ish, 20 to 18, depending on configuration. And that this is tracking extraordinarily well with a carbon which is sp3, sp2, and sp, meaning that a carbon that is sp hybridized is almost as acidic as an oxygen for a proton that is attached to that sp hybridized carbon. That when we look at the 16 versus 20, that these two numbers are very close, 45 and 40, 60 and 60. And so this idea that carbons all have the same electronegativity, carbons do not all have the same electronegativity. The carbon electronegativity changes with hybridization. And that's an important element to recognize as we go into the alkynes, okay? That hybridization is just as powerful as the change in element in terms of electronegativity and has the same sort of effects. The other thing to recognize is that this hybridization change comes with a change in orbitals as well, in the way that the orbitals are configured. And so when we look at a pi bond, one way to look at that pi bond is to take the molecule and to orient the molecule so that we look forwards and backwards and it sits in a flat plane. And this allows us to be able to see the pi bond which sits above the plane and the pi bond which sits below the plane. Actually, the part of the same pi bond is the orbital, the lobe that sits above and the lobe that sits below. And so this constitutes the positive and negative lobes of pi bond and how they're above and below the plane. When we look at an alkyne, the alkyne is linear. And so there's no other way to look at this other than we have a lobe that sits above. Here, I'll try to be a little bit more careful about how I'm drawing. So we have the lobe that sits above. These guys are one pi bond. And then orthogonal to this, there is another lobe that sits in front and a lobe that sits in back. And the lobe that sits in front also has plus and minus associated with it. And so this is the in-plane pi bond. And this is the forwards and backwards second orthogonal pi bond. Or that we have the two pi bonds that exist. So we have this alkyne completely surrounded by electron density, top and bottom, front and back. Also the bond lengths. The bond lengths change, right? And if we take a look at a sigma bond versus a pi bond versus an alkyne bond where there's two pi bonds, we also get a change in the bond length. And so understanding that bond length, if we look at a sigma bond versus pi in an alkene versus pi in an alkyne, that we start off with a fairly long bond, and then the bond gets progressively shorter. And that has to do with the hybridization as well. That when we look at the hybridization and it is sp3 to sp3, that what's happening there is that in order for the bond to form, we need to take the sp3 orbitals and we need to overlap the sp3 orbitals, which are fairly long orbitals. And the bond windups being formed in the union of those two orbitals. And so what that does is that takes and it sets the nuclei. If this is our nuclei, then this is the distance of the bond between the nuclei. So these are sp3 hybrids. When we look at an alkene, now we switch to sp2 hybrids. So as I switch to an sp2 hybrid, the sp2 hybrid is shorter in length. That means that when I bring the next sp2 hybrid next to it, in order to make the bond, that what happens if I line them up is that that was where the nuclei is, but now the bond distance is shorter. So these are the sp2 hybrids. The pi bond that goes along with that is really not contributing to the length. The length is really being contributed to by the size of the sigma bond that is created here. Sorry, the screen froze again. Which is funny because it wasn't freezing at all during. During lab. And now it's just going to be a jerk about it. Every time I lose it, it doesn't want to click back in. Let me stop this screen share. Try. Should go this time. There we go. Okay, and in the last one, what we're doing is an sp bond. So the SP bonds are even smaller and squatter. And we get an even shorter bond. And so bond length is related to hybridization in the amount of overlap that is needed between the orbitals. And the shorter the orbitals are that are used to make the bond, the shorter the bond is. And so bond length is proportional to hybridization. So that's an important aspect. So all of these things link together in order to start looking at the first sort of chemical reactions that we look at with alkynes. And the first reaction that we look at with an alkyne is the acidity. So in terms of an alkyne, the proton on an alkyne is acidic. Why is it freezing? What is going on? This is not working for me. Okay, so the first reaction that we look at is acidity. These protons have a pKa that is approximately 20, depending upon what else is attached to the alkyne. And that means that they can be deprotonated by using the appropriate base. And the base that we like to use is a lithium or sodium amide. And the reason is that these form the alkynyl anion, and we make NH3 ammonia, which has a pKa that is approximately 40, 45. And so it's a strong enough base to deprotonate the anion. And so we always go to some sort of either lithium amide, or we could do sodium amide. Sodium amide is a very common one to use too, almost probably see it more than we do with the lithium. To make the lithium or sodium amide is actually a fairly easy reaction. What we do is we take ammonia, liquid ammonia, and this is liquid ammonia is at minus 33 degrees Celsius. That's what temperature it needs to cool down to. It auto cools itself down in order to, here's what happens. When you take liquid ammonia and put it into a container, either a round bottom, or you'll see this done in a Dewar, a glass Dewar, which is sort of like a thermos. The liquid ammonia, when you put it in here, is colorless. It's looks just like water. But what happens is that liquid ammonia is evaporating at an extremely fast rate and boiling. And as it evaporates, as it turns to gas, and you release NH3 gas, it is all the higher energy molecules that are leaving the vessel. And as they leave the vessel, they auto cool. Essentially what's happening is, if you take a look at a Boltzmann distribution of molecular speeds and this is the temp, is the average, and this is the energy. And the percent of molecules with that energy. Then if this is the energy that's required for evaporation, activation energy, evap, then as all of these molecules here leave, these are all the hottest molecules. And as those go, then the Boltzmann distribution shifts and gets colder. And it's called evaporative cooling. And so this thing, as it evaporates, will cool itself down. And it will cool itself down below its boiling point, so it comes down to minus 33 degrees Celsius. Actually, the scary thing with ammonia is that when it gets on you, or when it's released in the environment, it will not only cool the environment down to minus 33, but because it utilizes all the heat from whatever it's touching, it can auto cool down to minus 60 very quickly. And it can create very, very low temperatures very fast. It can create frostbite, freezer burn, and you gotta be careful with it, in addition to its acid-base properties. What we do with this, with these solutions, is we take and we add sodium metal to it, or lithium metal. And in so doing, these things turn sky blue as the sodium radical dissolves into them. And as they turn sky blue, the reaction that's taking place is a reaction where some bubbling is occurring out of this, and you're losing hydrogen gas. And you're generating inside here a sodium radical that dissolves. It's called dissolving metal. And in the process, the sodium is reacting with NH3, two of them, and it takes, I believe, two of these guys. And what you make is sodium amide, NH2, and hydrogen gas. It's almost the exact same reaction that sodium does with water. It's just that when it does it with the ammonia, with NH3, it is less exothermic. It's a more controlled reaction, and it allows us to be able to produce sodium amide that we can then use as a base to do other reactions with. So that's sort of the whole background on that. Okay, so that's where the sodium amide comes from. And then we use that sodium amide to deprotonate alkynes. Now, what's the great thing about deprotonating an alkyne? Why is deprotonating an alkyne good? This guy, R minus, with sodium or lithium. This now is a carbon nucleophile. And that means that if it's a carbon nucleophile, that means that we can make carbon-carbon bonds. Wow, it does not want to stay. Attached. Maybe it's this one that's not on the right network. Or hang on one second. Let me just check something, make sure, see if I can figure out why we're dropping so frequently. Just making sure that I don't have a VPN that's trying to kick in on the computer as opposed to the iPad. Doesn't seem like it.
So, hey, Jason.
Please, go for it.
We wouldn't be able to proceed this reaction with, like, sodium hydroxide, right? That wouldn't be a strong enough base to depronate that alkyne.
That is correct.
Would it favor the, yeah, it wouldn't favor the product set. So we wouldn't be able to get that alkynyl anion or the carbon nucleophile, right?
That's correct. So the problem is in the pKa that when we look at taking and deprotonating it with the sodium amide, it does so because the conjugate that you create, which is the liquid ammonia, has a pKa that is in the 40 range. And this guy had a pKa that was in the 20 range. If you try and do this with hydroxide, the problem with hydroxide is the equilibrium. So
there's a left.
If we try to go sodium hydroxide and you're trying to do this and you end up with water, then the pKa on water is
like 15.
Yeah, 15, 16. And so pKa 20 and pKa 16, remember I said it favors the weak side, right?
Right.
And so by favoring the weak side, it's going to favor the other side over here. It will not proceed to any great degree. So that's the problem with sodium hydroxide. And the same thing with potassium terbutoxide, because the pKa on potassium terbutoxide is only 18.
So we would just need to use, you know, just a strong amine base, right? So yep. Like sodium amide or LDA. Okay.
LDA, that's correct.
LDA, okay. Sweet.
So must use either NaNH2 or lithium diisopropyl amide, LDA, which is the other one. In order to deprotonate these.
So we still have to keep in mind is one sodium amide, I'm stumbling over my tongue. So that would be a small base, sodium amide, and LDA is considered a bulky base?
LDA is considered a bulky base, yes. Sodium amide is considered a small base. But okay, so we still have in terms of deprotonating an alkyne, it doesn't matter small versus bulky.
Okay.
That's not important because there's no sterics around the alkyne, right? Because the alkyne is a terminal alkyne in order to be able to have this work. I am just struggling right now with this iPad. All right, time out. Stop the screen share. Start one more time. Okay. Let's see if this will find it. Ah, I bet nobody knows what that is. That was not intended to come up, but that's kind of cool.
What is that?
It is called a caliopora. And a caliopora is the device that was invented by chemist Lieberg. And it was the first device that transitioned chemists from working in different types of apparatuses to working in glass. And it was made out of blown glass, and it was used for analyzing carbon, and it was the first apparatus that allowed them to figure out what the what the amount of carbon was in different carbon samples. And they would burn the carbon and they would pass it through this device. And inside this device, they would have potassium hydroxide. And the potassium hydroxide would capture the CO2 that was being generated. And they would weigh this device before they bubbled the CO2 through it and after they bubbled the CO2 through it. And the mass would tell them exactly how much mass in carbon dioxide was gained. And they could then tell what the how much carbon content through the stoichiometry was actually in the carbon thing. So this is actually, this symbol was utilized as the American Chemical Society symbol and symbolized chemists in general. It was a very important symbol. They made pins out of it to distinguish and tell who were chemists. And it is the symbol of the American Chemical Society now. And it's on the American Chemical Society on every piece of literature that the American Chemical Society puts out. It is, and the pins that the American Chemical Society puts out has this device on it. It's a very, very cool device.
It's cool.
Okay. I was thinking about getting a tattoo. This was the tattoo I was thinking about getting.
That's the first thing that came to my mind too. That looks like a tattoo. That'd be a cool one.
It'd be a good tattoo, wouldn't it?
That is literally what I first came to mind. I know. That'd be kind of a cool tattoo.
That's what I was getting at. I should
do it. You should get it all on your back. So when you go to Burning Man.
No, I'm not getting that on your back. No, that'd be too big. Something more appropriate on a forearm or something would be good. All right. I have no tattoos, so this is it's a big decision for me. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking about getting the unit circle one time.
Yeah, the unit circle is good too. Okay, that's a far aside. Let's get back on track. I apologize. Okay. And new. Okay. So we're going to try this. This is a different iPad. We're going to see if this one is any better in stalling us out. And so what can we do here? With this types of thing, in looking at the alkynes as nucleophiles. This allows us to be able to go through and to take an alkyne in general. Now we can take a specific alkyne, we could do a specific synthesis, but what we're thinking here is that we can take an alkyne, we can deprotonate it with sodium amide. We can create the alkynyl anion. And then we can combine that with some suitable electrophile. So I can bring in this guy and we can do an SN2 reaction where we knock this out and we make a new carbon-carbon bond. So if we think about how many carbons it is that we're adding, we've added 3 carbons, 1, 2, and 3, and 3, 2, and 1, and there's the group that we've added and the new bond that we've created. Now this has some restrictions with it in terms of being able to make new carbon-carbon bonds like this. The alkyl halide
doesn't always have to be on a primary.
Yep, must be primary. Or reaction goes E2. On secondary and tertiary. So that's an important component there. Alkyl halide must be primary, or it'll go E1, E2. There are reactions that we can do with carbonyls with these, but we're not going to get into the carbonyl chemistry just yet. So this does allow us to make carbon-carbon bonds. And so now, The other key thing here is that we now have two ways to make carbon-carbon bonds. Now, Grignard reactions we haven't covered formally in lecture. We've covered them in lab, but we're going to add Grignard to this because that was our first one. So Grignard was allowing us to take an alkyl halide, react it with magnesium metal to make the Grignard reagent, which then we could take and we could also react with a primary alkyl halide. And we could link this up with a new carbon-carbon bond. Yeah, that works. And the other way is now with the alkynyl anion. So this allows us to be able to take any terminal alkyne and to one, treat it with sodium amide or LDA, producing the anion, and then two, reacting it with the halogen that is a primary halogen. So there we go. So those are our two ways to make carbon-carbon bonds. So that's one of the really big things about these is their acidity and being able to use that acidity to make new carbon-carbon bonds. However, it's limited in that whatever you're making the bond with has to be primary. So that's an important component there. All right. Beyond that, as we get away from the acidity, alkynes have very sort of similar reactions to the alkenes. So what I like to do is I like to take an alkene reaction and remind you about an alkene reaction. And let's do hydrogen bromide addition. So this is addition of HBr. Or we could think of this as HX, really. So let's remind ourselves about, first, the alkene reaction. That when we take HBr and do this with the alkene, the first step is the double bond reaches out, protonates it to form the more stable carbocation, and then the bromide comes in and attacks that in the second step to finish out and give us the Markovnikov addition of the HBr. How does that differ when it's an alkyne? The answer is not a whole lot. First thing is, we grab the proton. Now in grabbing the proton, we know that there's two choices, right? And so we need to consider those two choices. So in considering those two choices, it could grab the proton on this side, making that positive charge, or it could grab the proton on that side, making that positive charge. Now, I should say that these positive charges, I'm drawing them inappropriately because it's an sp hybridized carbon that the positive charge sits on. And so the question is, which one of these is more stable? If I look at A or B, which would be more stable, A or B? What do you think? Let's see where the chat is. I'm not seeing anything in the chat. I'm not hearing anybody say anything. Well, let's rank these carbocations. How would I describe this carbocation on A? Primary, secondary, or tertiary?
Primary.
It is indeed primary. What about the carbocation on B?
It's still on primary. Oh, secondary, sorry.
Secondary. Okay, so which carbocation is more stable, primary or secondary?
Secondary.
Secondary, that's it. Don't let it get too crazy in terms of messing with you. I mean, this guy is secondary and is more stable. The whole idea that there's this weird carbocation that's right next to a double bond, there's no resonance with the double bond because of the when you think of the double bond in this carbocation, the carbocation sits here and the pi bond sits out here and back, sort of back here, orthogonal to it. So the pi bond is sitting orthogonal to the empty p orbital. And as such, it cannot resonate into the empty p orbital. So there is no resonance. In order for there to be resonance, the orbitals have to overlap. The orbitals have to be in alignment, or no resonance can take place. So if we're sitting here, we're trying to consider resonance, we're trying to figure out what happens, we have to keep in mind that they're not two-dimensional, they're three-dimensional. And in order for orbitals to overlap in three dimensions, they have to be in alignment, they have to be in the same plane in order for them to align. So then that means that the bromide moves in on this step and binds here. And then it happens again. Alkenes are more reactive than alkynes. And so this whole thing happens again. And it grabs the proton again. And once again, we have two decisions. Once again, we need to look at it and say, all right, is it going to grab this proton such that all three protons end up on the same carbon? And I end up with this carbocation with the bromide next to it. Or, and I'm going to put that as this option up here. Or is it the other way around, that it grabs the proton on the carbon that the bromide is on, and the carbocation goes in the other spot. So now this is A and B again. And which one of these is more stable? A or B?
We want the cation or the carbocation at the secondary position, right? I feel like this has, so I'm trying to relate like Hammond postulate to this, and I'm trying to picture it.
We could do it with Hammond postulate, but Hammond postulate is more about the lower activation energy. We need to find the intermediate that is lower in energy to know which transition state is lower in energy. So Hammond postulate is, yes, the argument would be the correct argument, but before we do Hammond postulate or before we invoke it, we need to figure out which one of these two carbocations is more stable. So why did I draw in the lone pairs on the bromide?
So you can see that if you're going to be pushing electrons towards that positive.
That's right, because there's resonance associated with this. It's resonance stabilized. And the other one, in the absence of resonance, this guy serves as an electron withdrawing group. Because of its electronegativity. And so B is more stable. And by Hammond postulate, it would have the lower activation energy. And the next bromide, as it comes in on that position. And so the product that we get here is that the two bromides always end up on the same carbon. So the two bromides always end up on the same carbon. And just to show that resonance, halogens can have positive charges on them because they don't violate the octet rule. It still has two lone pairs, and if you count up all its electrons, it has 8 electrons around it still. So it's doing the same sort of job as oxygen is doing. Okay.
So just to recap on this, so because alkenes are easier to substitute than alkynes, this reaction will go again. It'll.
Yeah. It's, I think that what we say is that that for reactivity, the alkene is a more reactive species. And that when we take an alkyne and run it through this reaction, and we do HBr, that it is difficult to stop at this point. And so instead, what we do is we almost always do HBr, and we either write excess, or sometimes you'll see 2EQ, meaning two equivalents. So the EQ stands for equivalence. And then it always goes to completion, where we add the two bromides. So this is difficult to stop because the pi bond that results from this is more reactive. Than the alkyne, in the beginning alkyne. Okay, so next up is the reverse of this reaction. In the reverse of this reaction, we look at a reaction called double dehalogenation. And it's actually the formation of an alkyne. So here what we do is we take a dihalogen, and I'm gonna make this a longer molecule for a minute. Wait, what do I want to put here? No, I would just leave it like that. Br, and we react this with two equivalents of sodium amide. This is an E2 reaction. And what winds up happening is it pulls the proton. And eliminates out the bromide. And then it does it again. The only problem with this is that usually we don't just do it with two equivalents. I wrote two equivalents here, but there's a second step that needs to happen. And the second step is to add in H3O plus. And the reason is because when you have all this NH2 floating around here as an anion, it pulls the proton. And the original first product that you get is the anion. And then the job of the acid is to reprotonate it. So this second step here is because we're creating a terminal alkyne with really strong base, and it just winds up pulling the proton, and we would end up with the anion unless we protonate it on the backside. So these terminal ones need to be reprotonated. The nice thing is that this reaction works irregardless of the configuration of the bromides or the halogens. For instance, if I have a molecule that has a chloride and a chloride, and they are 1,2 dihalogen, the reaction still works. So if I treat it 1 with sodium amide, and 2 with dilute acid, I still end up with the same thing as a product. And so the reaction works whether they are 1,2, which is called vicinal, or it works when they are 2,2, or 1,1, this would be geminal. So it can work in either configuration. Vicinal or geminal. So let me ask this then. What happens if I take this molecule and I react it with Br2? It's from the last chapter. What does Br2 do with an alkene like this? Halogenation of an alkene. Grab your star chart. Look at your star chart quick.
Br2 is placed on both sides of the double bond, removing that double bond.
Right. Okay, and then what happens if I do 1 sodium amide, and let's say XS, and then 2 dilute acid H3O+.
Both the bromines would be removed, and you get you wouldn't get a triple bond.
Yes, you would.
Octanol anion.
Well, we don't get the anion because we added in the acid.
You just get, okay.
But we could get the anion if we wanted to. But look at what we've just done here. This is moving from an alkene to an alkyne. And so we've got a way to be able to make alkynes from alkenes. And we've got a way to be able to go from one to the other. Which is pretty sweet. Okay. Let's take another look. A look at another reaction that we do with alkenes. We had hydration. So we're just kind of going down the line, picking reactions that we did with alkenes. Let's remind us about the reaction with the alkene. So with the alkene, we would take and we would add water and H2SO4. And the first step was to grab the proton, figure out the more stable carbocation, attack by water, formation of the oxygen oxonium ion, deprotonation by some base, resulting in the formation of the alcohol, what we call the Markovnikov product, right? And so we ended up with an alcohol in that regard. How does that change when we do the same reaction with an alkyne? And I do water and H2SO4. Now, one thing that's different is these typically take a catalyst, mercury sulfate, HgSO4. So this is mercury 2 sulfate is a catalyst.
Then we're just gonna get a double bond to the oxygen, I believe.
You're right, but what I wanna do is I wanna go through the mechanism and see why and see where it happens and how it happens. So just looking at the alkynes and remembering alkyne reactions, yes. But let's look at the similarities in the reaction. The first thing that happens is the protonation. So we pick up the proton. In picking up the proton, we pick up the proton in exactly the sense that we would think, in that we get the more stable carbocation, the secondary carbocation. Once we get the more secondary carbocation, the next thing that happens is water comes in and binds to it. So everything so far is tracking analogously and is looking just right. I have the two protons on the terminal end. I have the water molecule and the oxonium ion. And then some base removes the proton. This takes me to a special functional group. This functional group is called an enol. And the enol is unique. Let's do enols in green. So this is an enol.
So that's where the lone pairs on the oxygen would form that double bond, removing the double bond in the middle.
And so what happens is enols spontaneously undergo what's called tautomerization. So the enol, if we think about having the acid in here that we've added in with the water, the enol lone pair pushes in, pushes out, grabs the proton, and produces a different type of oxonium ion, a carbonyl now, that is protonated as an intermediate, and it has picked up the additional proton from the acid, and then some base removes the final proton. And it gives us a ketone.
So the enol is specific to having the alkene and an alcohol in the same molecular structure.
Yeah.
That's what enol is. Okay.
What an enol means, let's do it this way.
Is an OH attached to a double bond.
Is an OH attached to a double bond. This is the alkene. This is the alcohol. And they pull the two last parts, the ol and the ene, and they make it an enol. And that's where that name comes from. And enols, anytime there's an enol, enols will spontaneously isomerize into their ketone form. So this is an equilibrium that cannot be stopped. And it's called tautomerization. Tautomerization is a reaction, that forms tautomers. And a tautomer are two compounds that differ by the location of a proton. I should say two isomers. That differ by the location of a proton. So these guys are tautomers. Special relationship like different types of isomers. We have enantiomers, we have diastereomers, now we have tautomers. Conjugates is another example. So that when we say a conjugate, these are two molecules that differ by one proton, not in its location, but by so that if I have water and hydronium, these guys are conjugates. In that they differ by one proton. Tautomers differ by the location of the proton. And this is the enol. This is the ketone. And this is called keto-enol tautomers, tautomerization. And it always favors the ketone. So you have to be careful. Anytime you see an enol, the enol is always temporary. The enol will always convert into its ketone or carbonyl form. We'll say enols are transient. They always convert to the ketone form. Or the carbonyl form. Okay, what's interesting about this is if we look at that terminal double bond, that anytime I have a terminal double bond and I go through and I do water and H2SO4, it always goes through this species after protonation. Because this is the more stable carbonyl. And so the water molecule, excuse me, more stable positive charge, water molecule always comes into this place on the more substituted carbon. And then when it goes through the isomerization, we always end up with the ketone. So the ketone is coming about because of the stability of the most stable carbocation. But what if I don't want the ketone? Is there a way to do something different? And to get the aldehyde?
Is that when you would add mercury sulfate?
No, the mercury sulfate gets added in here generally for these guys anyway. I'm leaving it out, but the mercury sulfate is part of a required catalyst that shows up in here. So whether you see the mercury sulfate or not, you should do the same reaction. But it's not the mercury sulfate that makes this go forward. So the question is, if I look at what's happening here, the protonation results in the formation of the most stable carbocation. That sets up the oxygen substitution. What has to happen for the oxygen to end up over here? If I look at it this way, watch this. This is a way to think about it. Let's number this number 1, 2, and the R group number 3. 1, 2, R group number 3. 1, 2, R group number 3. 2 is the most stable carbocation. 1, 2, 3. Somehow, I need to change the reactivity to put something over here, maybe not the carbocation, but how do I get the oxygen to attach on that side?
Oh, 9 BBN.
There we go.
And NaOH and water.
Okay. So when we did the hydroboration reactions, hydroboration allowed me to change the reactivity from a Markovnikov product to an anti-Markovnikov product. The reason that that works is because it flips the reactivity that the boron adds first and the hydride adds second, right? And so what I can do here is that if I take a look at hydroborating this, then what I can do is the boron is going to add first, the hydride second. I am going to get the partial positive buildup where I want, but the boron changes the reactivity. And so because the boron changes the reactivity, it's still a syn addition. It just allows me to add in the boron, and then through oxidation, I could swap that boron out for an oxygen. So this is an idea. Let's flesh this out and show how this works. Number one, we don't want to hydroborate more than once. So BH3THF, this has three equivalents and will hydroborate more than once. Nine BBN while not the ideal molecule for this, there's another one called thexylborane, which does this a little bit better. But 9-BBN only has one equivalent. And because of that, 9-BBN will hydroborate only once, one time, and is the tool of choice here. So this is what we want to use is 9-BBN. It's not because of the sterics. We're using it because it has only one equivalent of hydride. And so it's these guys, one, two, three. There's my three equivalents. Here's my one equivalent. That's what I'm keying into. That's what's important in this chemical reaction. Then, when I use 9-BBN, this is how the reaction proceeds. The boron adds slightly ahead of the hydrogen. Electrons go this way and this way, leading me to a transition state. Where I'm getting buildup of partial minus and partial positive, and electrons are flowing around the ring system. Once that happens, and I get the syn addition, then I go through and I replace the boron with oxygen. I do that through the oxidation step. Sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. That takes and directly replaces the boron with the alcohol. That then can spontaneously tautomerize. And as it tautomerizes, the lone pair kicks in, pushing the electrons out to grab a proton, and the whole tautomerization takes place. We'll go through this intermediate which is the protonated aldehyde. Base takes the proton. And we wind up with the aldehyde. And so we can direct whether or not we get a ketone or an aldehyde by the choice of reagent that we use. Is that making sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so then the only other thing really is looking at what happens if I don't have a terminal alkyne. What happens if I have an internal alkyne? What happens if I take this and I do water and H2SO4?
Are you at 50-50?
We do. So we get 50-50 where the carbonyl shows up on 2 and the carbonyl shows up on 3. They're both secondary positions, meaning no selectivity. And so what we end up with is, 2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I end up with 2, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 3. And this is 1, So that was on two and on three, and I end up with 50-50 mix. No selectivity. What if I do this? Same starting material, but I do it with 9 BBN. And then oxidation. Now what happens? Now you're asking the question, is it better to go this way or is it better to go this way? And which one of these is better?
The first one, because of the hysterics.
We're saying that's number one and this is number two?
Yes.
And the answer would be correct. That the hysterics here, because of this being a sigma bond and free rotation about that sigma bond, there's lots of hysterics here. And so this one is definitely going to be lower energy. And then where is that going to put the oxygen? On what 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, which element, which atom number gets the oxygen?
Primary, the on one.
Careful.
On two, right?
On two. So Brian, careful that what's happening is the bond is being made here and here.
Oh, so yeah.
Two or three. Two or three. So you're right. It's the less side. It's number two, but not number one, number two. So that means that when we draw this molecule, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, there's seven. There's our carbonyl. And that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And this becomes major. All right, so all those things that we're thinking through. Okay.
And I think so 9 BBN is going to form the aldehyde if we use, yeah. And then
9 BBN will form an aldehyde if it's a primary alkyne.
Okay, primary alkyne. I read that one.
And so if it's a primary alkyne, you can get the aldehyde, but you cannot get an aldehyde on an internal alkyne. There's no way on an internal alkyne to get an aldehyde.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Okay. Unless we migrate the bond. We'd have to migrate the bond, and then we could figure it out. But that's more work. Okay. I feel like we're making good progress now. I feel like you guys are starting to catch the rhythms. You're starting to know what to look for with me a little bit better. This is all seeming good. No, quiz three is not due today, right? No, I got to cancel that thing out. Nobody wants to do quiz three. The quiz dates and things are all messed up. And my circumstance has still been immensely complicated up here. So no, I need to get online and get rid of that quiz three and give you an appropriate quiz. Because quiz three is the wrong quiz for right now. So no quiz due today. Or at least that quiz three not. I'm going to get online later today and I'm going to try to put up a more appropriate quiz and give you guys some time to do it. So ignore that quiz three, please.
We turned in the rough draft for the report.
The rough draft, what I would say is if you want me to look at your rough draft, I would email it to me because I haven't given you a place to turn it in Canvas. So if you want me to look at it, there's no requirement to turn in a rough draft. I'm encouraging you to send me a rough draft to look at and just send it to me by email. And I'll take a look at it and give you back some feedback and give you back some comments.
Wait, I was able to submit it somewhere.
Yeah, so was I.
Yeah.
Okay, you may have submitted the rough draft in place of the actual document. In which case, that's okay too. What I can do is I can go and I can look at that. If that's, maybe that's a good way to do it. But then when we actually do the final submission, you'll have
email
to
it.
Submit a second document, and you'll have to go in on that same page and just resubmit. And it will overwrite the old one with the new one. In fact, I'll be able to see them both. That's actually not a bad way to do it. Let's do it that way. So if you want me to look at your draft, go ahead and upload a draft. And I'll take a look at it in Canvas and give you some feedback. And then go ahead and upload that final draft next week in the exact same place, and it'll overwrite it.
Okay. I had a question about that. So I know when you were going through the rubric and as well as the format, I noticed that we don't really have access to look at the equipment that we're using. And then, but in your format example, you name dropped a lot of specific equipment, like the machinery that we're using. Is it okay to pull that from yours?
Brian,
how do we cite that it's your, that we're getting that from you?
Don't. I'm giving it to you because I was the one in the lab and I used the equipment, and I'm just giving it to you. So you don't have to give me an attribution. You don't have to cite me. Just be careful. I was going to say, just be careful to only use the equipment that we used in the lab. The NMR and the mass spec and the other things that I gave in that example, just delete those components out. The only thing that we used in the lab was the melt temp and the IR.
I was looking through all my old material and I found an old FTIR, or no, mass spectrometry, I can't pronounce the word, data chart that I was able to get from when I was doing the Zerubis class, I think. So I attached that on there for the FTIR.
That works. That's fine.
But I'm not sure. It's pretty close. It's pretty close to what your numbers are. I mean, they're like within, a decimal off.
That's the great thing about IR is that the IR wavelengths are fairly specific, and they come out fairly close.
So I attached that one on there because it was actually my work, but but it was really close to your number, so I just went with those. But as far as the masses, I went with your numbers from the lab recording videos.
Good, that's exactly what you need to do.
Yeah.
And things like scales is kind of like, scales are kind of generic, are they?
Yeah, generally within using a balancer scale, we don't generally cite that model number in terms of the work that's done there. It's really more the analytical tools, the FTIR and those types of things where we're examining melting points and spectroscopy. Those things we're more interested in. Okay. All right. Thanks for a good session, guys.
Thanks, Jason.
Okay. You guys take care. We'll see you soon.
See you, Jason.
See ya.